From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Today's show is about weather, climate, and carbon, and how one very conservative Republican wants other Republicans to stop denying climate change. First, I'll discuss weather and climate with Brian McInerney, hydrologist with the National Weather Service out of Salt Lake City. He'll give us a recap on what this past summer was like, temperature and precipitation-wise, what records were broken here and elsewhere around the country, and what the latest trends are with respect to the planet's ongoing warming. Then in the second half of the show, I'll play an interview I had with Bob Inglis, a six-term Republican congressman out of South Carolina. Bob was on his way to his seventh term in Congress when he had the temerity to admit to his constituents that he believed in human-influenced climate change. A man who had 100% rating with the Christian Coalition, the National Right to Life Association, and a grade of A with the National Rifle Association, lost his re-election by 42 points. Since then, Bob has gone on to establish the Energy and Enterprise Institute, an organization dedicated to using the concepts of free enterprise, limited government, and the moral obligation we have as citizens to provide clean energy and care for the planet. Bob Inglis is in Salt Lake City speaking at several venues starting today, and on Wednesday night he will speak to the entire Utah State Legislature, straight into the lion's den of climate denial. My interview with former Congressman Bob Inglis on the second half of the show. Our connections with and impacts upon our environment, that's This Green Earth. And it all gets started right after these words from our underwriter.
Join us for The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Head into summer with us as we explore health, nutrition, and lifestyle with the experts.
From going gluten-free to finding your balance.
From bike position to relationship alignment.
From the educational journey to navigating wellness.
That's Wednesdays at 9 a.m. on The Mountain Life, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa, Park City Clinic, and Grand Valley Bank.
Park City Restore turns your donation of gently used home furnishings, construction materials, and furniture into affordable housing through Habitat for Humanity in Summit and Wasatch counties. Check habitat-utah.org for a list of items accepted at the Restore during business hours, Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 6. Restore is located in Silver Summit at 6280 Silver Creek Drive. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch counties is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, this is Gordon Raymond with Republic Services, your recycling and garbage services provider, and a proud supporter of KPCW. Recycling pickup in Summit County is now every other week. Remember, recycling materials go in your larger blue or brown bin. Gray is for garbage. AlliedWasteUtah.com/Summit County.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability and our relationship with the environment and impacts upon it. I'm Chris Cherniak. My co-host, Nell Larson, remains on assignment in Bhutan for the next few weeks. She'll be back near the end of this month with a full report on her trip to Bhutan. But let's get to this. It's fall, and the leaves in and around Park City are all turning brown. They're turning brown. So why is that? Typically it's the oaks and the sugar maples that will turn their oranges and their reds. But this year they've just turned brown, and that's a function of a couple of things. Not enough water during the summer, but also not enough cold temperatures at night. The trees, the best colors during the fall are when you have warm, sunny days like we're going to have today, but cold, clear nights. And the combination of those things, without going into all the details, sets up the chemistry within the tree that allows those reds and oranges to come out as they turn. So what's happening here? Why have our trees just decided to turn a very exhausted-looking brown and not reds and oranges? Well, we'll get into some of that with our first guest, Brian McInerney. He is a hydrologist, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service out of Salt Lake City, and he joins us pretty much every solstice and equinox to give us an update on the past season's weather, temperatures, and precipitation and events. And he's here again. I know he's a few days early because I think when is the fall start this year? The 22nd?
Yeah, I think it's the 22nd.
Sunday the 22nd. So you're here a few days earlier, but that's okay.
That's all right.
We appreciate you taking the time to come in and chat with us about what's going on in the weather and climate issues. So, Brian, thanks for joining me on This Green Earth.
Yeah.
Let's try to do the conversation. Let's start local, and then we'll go to national issues, and then we'll wrap it up or turn to more global-related trends and events going on with warming and other weather-related conditions, yeah, climate-related issues. So first of all, locally, what was this past summer like?
It was really one of extremes. We had the hottest summer on record in Salt Lake City going back to 1872. We had the hottest average temperature that we've ever seen, and that's 80.7 degrees. The runner-up was 79.3 degrees in 2007. We also came,
so that's 80.7 degrees. That's the average temperature for the day.
Between the high and the low. And then you divide it, and you come up with an average temperature for that day.
80.7, okay.
And really where that, why it's so high is the nighttime lows were so warm. That's really where it came up. We had 20 days over 100 degrees, and the record for that is in 1960 and 1994 where they had 21. So we were one day short of that. We broke the number of 95-plus days with 52 of those, and the record prior to that was 51 days in 1940 and 1961. And then when you look at the number of 90-degree-plus days, we were sixth with 72 of those. But if you look at and you can play these temperature games all the time. You can kind of keep looking at the different ones. But one of the forecasters in our office looked at the annual number of days with minimum temperatures greater or equal to 70 degrees. And the closest that we had come prior to this was 30 days, and that was in 2004 and 2007, and we hit 45. So we set a record, a pretty big record for that. And again,
45 days of again what?
45 days of minimum temperatures greater or equal to 70 degrees. So that just looks at the nighttime lows, and that's the big signature we see with our warming climate is the nighttime lows do not get as cold as they used to be. And when you average the high for that day.
What is the average nighttime low?
Well,
it's got to be in the 60s?
Yeah, it's dropping every day while we're
right. But during the summertime, it's going to be it'll at least get down below 70. You're saying that roughly half the season, 45, let's say 90-day season.
Yeah.
The nighttime low was 70 degrees or above.
Yeah.
So extremely warm nights.
Yeah, extremely warm nights. And that's where this shows out up a lot is the minimum temperatures.
Right. We'll get to that when we start talking about, warming trends on a global level or so, how important minimums are. So that's the conditions. We had record high temperatures, 52 roughly, let's say 52 out of, again, a 90-day season, 52 days out of 90 days, it was 95 degrees or warmer.
Or greater. And 20 of those were greater than 100 degrees.
100. And how many of those days were record-breaking for that date?
I don't have that data with me now, but it's right up there.
But if it got above 100 degrees, it's approaching a record if it didn't tire. I know back at the end of June, there was a string of 5 or 6 days in a row that broke daily highs, the last 4 days of June and the first 3 days of July or something like that, down in Salt Lake City, we're talking about, broke the daily record. Every day was it was above 100 degrees for that string of days, and they all was 101. Yeah. I think it was 104 on one day. I remember being down there. It's uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable. And
even though it's a dry heat.
Yeah. It seemed like we were breaking records a lot. You know, every time I would come in the office, somebody would be talking about more heat records that we had.
Okay,
broken.
Why? What was the, why was it so hot?
Well, if you look starting back in May in the spring, we were warmer than normal because we were just dominated by this high pressure that didn't allow really any weather, any cold fronts. It just deflected everything to the north of us and a little bit to the south. And then we hit June, and June didn't have one drop of precipitation in Salt Lake. We had only a trace. A trace is just you can see water in the can, but there really wasn't any measurable precipitation. And we went the entire month without any precipitation. And anytime you do that, when there's just a lack of rainfall, things get hotter pretty quick. And that's what we saw. And then what happened was in July, the monsoon kicked in, and it kicked in a really big way. Hmm. And when you see the flooding in Colorado that's occurred, southern Utah and Utah in general also had a lot of flash flooding and river flooding. On the years prior, the highest amount of flash flood warnings that the Salt Lake City office, weather forecast office, has issued was 63 flash flood warnings in a season. And this year we're up to 122 as of 2 days ago.
We've doubled it?
Yeah, we've doubled it.
Wait a minute. The previous high was 63?
63 flash flood warnings we had issued.
And this year we have 122. And we still have, of course, another 2 days left.
Right. And we'll see what happens after this. But we had extensive flooding throughout southern Utah starting in July. And it really went nonstop all the way till yesterday. We filled up Lake Powell 2 feet, and it's still going up with the storm that just hit in this past week. And it was the same weather system that moved into Colorado and did that extensive flooding that we saw there. And why this flooding occurred for so long is what happened was the pattern set up where if you can visualize a high pressure off to the east of Utah, and it's rotating clockwise. Mm-hmm. Now, off to our west was a low pressure, quite a large low pressure that's rotating counterclockwise. So you have this weather system that's pulling moisture up down from Mexico, Arizona into Utah. And with our temperatures being so warm as they were, now we're adding all this moisture. All we needed was some daytime heating mm-hmm. to produce some pretty dramatic thunderstorms. And that really brought a lot of flooding in. And then we had what's called a cutoff low that's down by the border of Nevada, Utah, and Arizona that just spins. It's smaller, but it spins by itself. And it kind of compressed all of this air mass into Utah and Colorado because the high was still sitting out over the east. But now it brought a air mass of low-level moisture that is just saturated at low elevations. And that air mass moved in, and just the slightest bit of dynamics would cause widespread, low-intensity rainfall across a really big, wide area. It was similar to 2006 when we filled up Lake Powell 5 feet, and that air mass produced widespread flooding through southern Utah and brought the weather that we saw here, where our air mass was just saturated. We had rain up here. And that moved into Colorado.
So basically a combination of low pressures to the east of us and to the west of us, and then this cutoff low down south creates this moisture pump, I guess, a pump set up to bring up moisture from Mexico, from the Gulf.
From the Pacific.
From the Pacific into this area. And now getting back to the flash flood warnings is perhaps doubling the previous record. Might that also be a function of better reporting or, better granularity in the reporting of flash flooding too?
Yeah, I think there's some of that. I think people with iPhones and the ability to tweet what we've got going, I think that did have something to play into it.
But still, that's 100% above the previous round. That's a big difference.
Yeah, it was nonstop, and these floods were really big. We'd see these washes, and people who were canyoneering in slot canyons were getting stranded and injured, and we didn't have anybody die this year, but we had a lot of close calls. I know the search and rescues were going full-time, and Zion National Park and Capitol Reef were closing down, and roads were being closed in Grand Staircase. It was really an active monsoon we had this year.
And well, perhaps the fact that people didn't die is because we have better warning systems out.
We have better communications.
Okay, yeah.
We still have the issue of when you're in a slot canyon, who's going to see the flash flood warning? We still are trying to figure out how to do that. But we have forecasts now 2 days out that say the potential for flash flooding is pretty high. You might want to change your plans.
Well, perhaps you shouldn't be in a slot canyon.
When you wake up
in the morning and there is a risk associated.
Yeah.
Okay. No, but that's behavior.
Yeah, that's a whole different
that's
thing.
Human behavior.
Yeah.
And, so we got rainfall.
Mm-hmm.
So people say, hey, this is good. I thought we were in a drought. Now we're getting flash flooding and, you know, Lake Powell's water levels are going up by feet. But is this the way we want our rainfall to occur? You know, do we want it to occur? Does it matter if it occurs in a very dramatic short-term period? Or is it better to have it happen over, you know, a more long, a chronic type event, 1 inch, a half inch here, you know, 3/4 of an inch there? Does it matter how we get our rain?
Yeah, it does matter. What we want optimally is for the rainfall to come, in a wide aerial space with low intensity rainfall. And what we're getting, and for the most part, is high intensity rainfall falling. And then when we had that low level moisture come in, we just had heavy rain all over in a short period of time. And when we talk short period of time, we had about a 3 day span. And unfortunately, most of that runoff just goes away. We did fill up Lake Powell 2 feet, and it's still going up today. But it would have been better if we could make it last and let it soak into the soils and not cause the destruction we're seeing. And unfortunately, when you look at the climate change research, a lot of our precipitation in the wintertime, they indicated, will come above normal amounts, but it'll come in shorter bursts, more intense rainfall with less frequent storms. And we're actually seeing that right now with storms coming out of the Pacific Northwest during the wintertime. They're becoming less frequent but more intense.
All right, let's turn to national related issues. But first, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Brian McInerney. He is a senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service out of Salt Lake City, and we're here talking about, of course, weather and climate related issues on both a local and national basis. We covered the local issues this past summer. Now let's turn to national related issues. What was this summer like? You know, on a national U.S. contiguous basis, temperature-wise, was it any sense of how we have
temperatures,
hot records?
Yeah, temperatures in the Southwest in the beginning, while we had records here in Utah, a lot of the West was also breaking records all around us. And in the early parts of the summer, we didn't have much precipitation at all. So a great portion of the West was in a drought. And we still are in some pretty severe drought categories. Utah was not as bad as, say, some of the other areas, New Mexico, Arizona. And then the monsoon hit, and we've brought our precipitation levels up above normal for the past 2 to 3 months, really for the summer months. And when you look at the Midwest, they've had very dry conditions. They're not doing well at all. And they've had such a terrible drought over multi-years that they need to get a lot more precipitation. And this is where most of our crops are grown. So what you see now is the West is very cold and wet for the past 60, 45 days. The East Coast now has had heat extremes, and they're dealing with a lot of very hot temperatures. It kind of flip-flopped, I guess.
So going back to those low pressure systems that were set up and the cutoff low down south of here, that moisture pump, is that why we had the extreme event in Colorado?
Yeah. Colorado also had a tap from the Gulf. The Gulf moisture came up.
So they get
the high pressure off to our east had moved out, opened the door. The cutoff low brought the moisture up from the Pacific, but also the tropical moisture from the Gulf of Mexico came up, and, okay. and that's what really hammered those guys. But the same big air mass that was moving in also produced all the flooding we saw in southern Utah.
Briefly, this incredible situation north of Denver, one in a 1,000-year event, I've
yeah.
read.
Yeah, that's what I've seen, the precip amounts for the
so less than a 1% chance that this would happen.
Yeah.
A 1/10 of 1%.
One tenth of 1% of this happening on any day.
And this is life changing up there. This is earth changing in a sense. You know, this isn't just flooding. This is probably going to cut new
yeah.
new riverbeds and streambeds and make huge life-changing conditions there.
Yeah, the channels that you see around where you live are formed by the amount of precipitation and runoff you get typically over a long period of time. And when you get these big events that they've seen in Colorado, you'll see larger channels and mm-hmm. sediment loads changing, and it'll reshape the ground.
That's what will be really fascinating.
Yeah.
To those who study that type of geological changes.
Yeah, now throw in the burn scars that we're seeing throughout the West. That increases your runoff dramatically. Where you have a 25-year rain event, I read where it now brings a 100-year runoff event because the rainfall runoff relationship has changed so much when you burn a hillside. That, and we've seen this here at Alpine and the dump fire near Saratoga Springs and some of the other areas, Clay Springs, we've all had some very big debris flows. And in the case of Alpine, destroyed some of the houses down there and caused these mud flows that are really massive. Whereas if you didn't have the burn scar, you would just have runoff or maybe a lot more infiltration into mm-hmm. the soil. But that's not the case once the hillside is burned.
Let's hold there. I got to take a break. We're at the bottom of the hour and I get some underwriters in. When we come back, we'll continue that talk about burn scars and debris flow, specifically with the Rockport 5 fire, what potentials there are there for that to happen. And then we'll talk a little bit about warming trends on a global basis. It's This Green Earth. We'll be back right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
This is Ann from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch. We're proud to have helped KPCW grow and flourish since 1983. Park City Nursery and the Tree Ranch have a variety of products to help your yard and garden do the same. Flowers, seeds, shrubs, and trees, water-wise sprinklers, consulting, and landscaping. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Hi, this is Stanton Jones from Silver Mountain Sports Club and Spa, a longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide our members over 80 weekly fitness classes, cardio and weight training centers, racquetball, 3 swimming pools, a women's only fitness room, and a full service salon and spa. Online at silvermountainsportsclub.com. Be stronger, live healthy, play longer.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and our connections with the environment and the impacts upon it. I'm Chris Cherniak, and joining me in the studio this morning is Brian McInerney, senior hydrologist with the National Weather Service out of Salt Lake City, and he comes in here every 3 months or so, every season, to give us a wrap-up on the past season's temperatures and precipitations, and we've been through all that. I wanted to finish up our conversation before the break about burn scars and debris flows, and we're all kind of familiar with what those are and the potential. How about the Rockport 5 fire? It wasn't large in terms of acreage. It did a lot of damage. Any debris flows from that or potential for that?
No, yeah, there's a potential for debris flow over this area. There was some areas of high severity burn where the residence time of the fire over certain areas lasted, so it produced hydrophobic soils and burned away the vegetation and produced watershed conditions that'll kick out a lot of runoff with a certain amount of rain. And with debris flows, what happens is that once the raindrop comes out of the sky, in the past, it's had vegetation to slow the physics of a raindrop hitting mm-hmm. the ground. But now you don't have that vegetation, so the raindrop is coming down. It hits the soil, and it disturbs the soil and moves a couple of particles of dirt. And those particles get hit by more raindrops, and then you have one moving two moving four moving 16, and then you have exponential movement of the upper watershed, and then the whole thing starts sliding because you don't have the root structure that holds the hillside in place. You also have those hydrophobic soils, which don't allow infiltration. It's like a Gore-Tex jacket on the side of the hill. So now you have this mass moving down the hill. And the potential at Rockport 5, we originally estimated at a half an inch in about a half an hour. So if we got a half an inch of rainfall occurring in a half an hour, we would see movement. And since that time, we've had a little less, and we did not have movement, which was nice because then that tells us the hillside might be a little more stable. Probably some of these areas didn't get burned as bad. Another thing in our favor is that the runout, originally I worried that it was going to go into Rockport Reservoir and kind of mess up the water quality. But the road there, the State Road 32, I think it is, is actually high enough that the road cut will capture most of the normal size debris flows that come down out of that watershed and not make it into the reservoir. And that was a nice thing to see. It'll definitely jam up the culvert, but that's small change compared to having this cover the road or maybe knocking a car into the reservoir.
Right, right. Okay. And we had a fairly wet weekend, cold, clammy weekend, then it seemed like I heard anything about any events going on there. So far, so good.
So far, so good.
And if we get any luck, instead of rain, it'll be snow in another few weeks.
So. Yeah, and then the threat goes away.
Okay. We got a few more minutes. Let's talk global issues. What do you see in this past, since you've been on last in June, what's going on globally with respect to warming?
One thing I did notice was that the NOAA scientist we're working with NASA, the NASA scientists, to try and find out why, while climate change continues, we continue to set heat records and it keeps getting warmer and warmer. The rate of warming over, say, the past 7-8 years has slowed. While it's still warm, it's still getting warmer, the rate has slowed down, and they couldn't figure that out. Because when they would model it, it would indicate that we should be warming at a much faster rate. Mm-hmm. It should be going up quickly. And they did a study and fed information into their model for the equatorial Pacific. And when they modeled it with a colder equatorial Pacific like we've had, then the warming slowed, which indicated that the amount of heat in the atmosphere is an uptake into the ocean. And that heat is, while it's still warming, we're not seeing it in the atmosphere, it's warming the actual waters of the ocean. And the feeling is once we come out of what's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, and that goes from cold to very warm temperatures for the next 10 years or so, then we'll see the rate of warming increase again. And I thought that was interesting.
And that increase could be fairly dramatic.
Could be fairly dramatic.
Step up.
Yeah, because what's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is an area of the Pacific in somewhat in the northwest. And these areas stay warmer, colder for longer periods of time than if you look at the equatorial Pacific, where El Nino and La Nina change somewhat frequently. Mm-hmm. But the Pacific, the northern Pacific, they go even by decadal every 10 years, every decade. And it stays colder or warmer roughly. And it's been in a cold phase, and they think that's the reason why we haven't seen our temperatures ramping up as fast as they would have thought.
And when do we expect this oscillation to switch from cold to warm?
I really don't know. I don't have that answer. But I would think it's coming up on, it's going to change probably 2-3 years.
2-3 years. Okay. So we can continue to see kind of a slower than expected warming trends on a global level. But once this oscillation switches from a more of a cold environment to a warmer environment, we could see a fairly dramatic step up, escalator type step up. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. We gotta wrap up. Good. Anything else, Brian?
No, I think that's good. Thanks for the invitation.
And I welcome you to hang around because I'm going to go right into our next guest. Last week, I had an opportunity to sit down with Bob Inglis. He's a former Republican congressman, six-term, 12-year Republican congressman out of South Carolina. And he was on his way to his seventh term in Congress when he had the audacity in a meeting to admit to his constituents that he believed in human-influenced climate change, which apparently is not a good thing to do when you're in South Carolina. And now here's a man who had 100% rating with the Christian Coalition, the National Right to Life Association, and a grade of A with the National Rifle Association. He lost his election by 72-29%. Now, this is a man who would typically won all of his other previous elections getting 60 to, in some cases, 70% of the vote. And now it flip-flopped. He's gone on to establish what's called an institute called the Energy and Enterprise Institute. We'll learn more about this in the interview. And he's here this week to give a couple of talks. I'll give you a couple of details on that after the interview. Here's my conversation with Bob Inglis. Bob Inglis, he's a former U.S. Republican congressman for the state of South Carolina. He served that state between the years 1992 and 1998, and again between 2004 and 2010. In July of 2012, Bob became the founder and executive director of the nonprofit Energy and Enterprise Initiative. Bob, I want to thank you for joining me on the show today.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be with you.
Well, let's start here. Give us a little background on what the Energy and Enterprise Initiative is all about and why you decided to found this initiative.
The Energy and Enterprise Initiative exists to prepare the country for a free enterprise solution on energy and climate. And, of course, we start that with conservatives because they're the champions of free enterprise. And so we want to make sure they know that that free enterprise has a solution here.
You came out of Congress with this idea in mind. You saw, I guess, an absence of this perspective out there?
Yeah, I think that conservatives aren't exactly championing right now solutions on energy and climate, as you might have noticed. But when conservatives are confronted with the evidence of the problem of climate change, the assumed solution is so unacceptable, which would seem to be a larger government that regulates things, caps things, trades them, creates bureaucracies, taxes more, grows the nanny state. All of that sounds very unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So, therefore, conservatives go back to asking, well, maybe there's not really a problem. So what we hope to do is break that connection, help them to see that they've got the answer. They're the kid in class that needs to raise his or her hand because they've got the answer. It's free enterprise. It's a true cost comparison between competing fuels.
Yeah, I agree with you because I heard Newt Gingrich once say that the reason that conservatives have such a problem being environmental stewards is that they see it equated to three things: more regulations, which equals bigger government, which is going to equal more taxes. And any one of those three things is anathema to the conservative construct. You put all three of those things together and you get kind of the trifecta of bad news.
Storm there, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And so that's what you're trying to address, that it is possible to be a conservative and also to be a good steward of the environment.
Right. It's basically actually reminding people there's a role for government. It is to be the honest cop on the beat that forces accountability on all the fuels to say, listen, hold your soot on your property and be fully accountable for all your emissions. Don't be dumping that in the air and letting socializing your costs while privatizing your profits.
Mm-hmm.
That's an unaccountable system that conservatives really don't like. By the way, many progressives don't like either. And so if we could bring that accountability to the energy marketplace and say, all fuels, be fully accountable for all your costs. We're not going to subsidize any of you anymore. You're on your own. You figure out how to compete in the marketplace. And so in that scenario, what we believe would happen is that consumers would drive innovation. So if I knew the true cost, for example, of coal-fired electricity at my house in South Carolina, I'd be looking for a solar hot water heater, for example. But I don't look for a solar hot water heater because it doesn't make any economic sense to look for one right now. Because I paid for the full cost of coal-fired electricity, not as a heater, but through an opaque healthcare system. I pay for that soot going up in the air. All right, I pay for it in Medicare, Medicaid taxes. I pay for it in cost shift to the hospital. I pay for it in higher insurance premiums. I'm paying. And my children and grandchildren will pay for the climate cost. So there's no such thing as a free lunch.
It sounds like it's possibly I'm going to pay more at the pump for my gas or my diesel. Or like you said, I'm going to pay more for my electricity from a coal-fired power plant.
That's, of course, our huge challenge is first we got to deal with the C problem, you know, carbon, which some people think is not a problem. So we got to convince them of that. But then the other is to convince them the wisdom of a tax swap,
mm-hmm.
that it makes sense that, yes, it is a problem. If we're just going to increase my cost at the meter for my electricity, well, that is a problem. But if you give me a corresponding tax cut, then I've got money to buy that solar hot water heater. I'm innovating then. I'm actually expanding the economy, creating jobs. I'm cleaning up the air, and I'm improving, in some ways, national security if it deals with transportation. And so it's a triple play for this American century.
Okay. Sounds good to me. What are the challenges in trying to convince either fellow conservatives or, like you say, some progressives that don't like this idea?
Of course, for progressives, here's a little bit of a concern that do you really think that the free enterprise system can deliver solutions that quickly? And some feel that, we need to regulate it because that'd be more certain. For them, I'd say, well, take a look at your smartphone and ask whether that was regulated pretty heavily or whether that was actually free enterprise driving that innovation very rapidly. I think we can have the same kind of innovation that rapidly when it comes to energy once these market distortions are removed. And then in the case of conservatives, the challenge is to get them to overcome their inferiority complex. We conservatives apparently think we're no good when it comes to energy and climate. We just think we're no good. But actually, we're very good. We got the answer. It's free enterprise. It's not command and control regulation. It's not control this and trade that and cap that. It's rather just put all the cost in on all the fuels, a true cost comparison between competing fuels, government being the honest cop on the beat, problem is solved. So it really takes just conservatives stepping up and not shrinking in science denial, but rather stepping forward and engaging.
Less carbon-based pollution going into the atmosphere. But like you said earlier, Bob, there are some, I'll say many conservatives, who don't believe that carbon is a problem, that carbon dioxide is an issue. Is it too late to convince that generation that there is an issue here?
Well, I think there's actually some movement on that. I think I've seen polling data on this. I've surely seen it anecdotally that the people that say it's a total hoax, the disputers of the science, are actually in the shrinking number. Those folks are gravitating toward a different camp, which says, okay, climate change is real, but we don't know whether it's human-caused. Now, of course, I'm in the camp of saying it's real and it's clearly human-caused.
Yeah.
And there are clear risks from this problem of climate change. But I would say to the other two camps, if you don't think it's human caused, well, but if humans possess a solution, would we not go forward with the solution and exercise stewardship over this glorious creation?
Right.
And to the people who think it's a complete hoax, what I'd say is, okay, let's stipulate for a moment that it's a complete hoax. You're a conservative that says it's a hoax. I don't believe it's a hoax, but let's stipulate for a moment that it is. Wouldn't you want to untax income and put a tax on anything else? Pine cones, oak leaves, tax anything but income. So why not tax carbon?
How much of this, too, is an effort to reach out to the next generations of conservatives that are out there, the 20s and 30-somethings, who believe that, you know, that you can be a conservative and also want to protect the environment?
Oh, yeah, you're really onto something there, Chris. This is about the future. And so where we find real success is talking to college Republicans, Federalist societies at law schools, energy clubs at business schools. They're young enough and future-oriented enough to be with us, and we also hope that they will be effective ambassadors to their parents and grandparents.
Let's take a break real quick for some underwriters here. We're talking with Bob Inglis. He's a former congressman from South Carolina, talking about climate change and his perspectives on that, and also how a conservative perspective and constructs could help address clean energy and clean air issues. We'll be back with the second half of my interview with him right after these words from some underwriters.
Park City Restore turns your donation of gently used home furnishings, construction materials, and furniture into affordable housing through Habitat for Humanity in Summit and Wasatch counties. Check habitat-utah.org for a list of items accepted at the Restore during business hours, Wednesday through Saturday, 10 to 6. Restore is located in Silver Summit at 6280 Silver Creek Drive. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch counties is a nonprofit organization.
I'm Scott Chester with the Park City High School Booster Club. Keep in touch with all things Miners with our weekly Miner Nation Report. We'll bring it to you every Monday during morning news with Leslie Thatcher and in the afternoon on the Local View with Randy Barton. Highlights, scores, schedules, all things Miners every Monday. The Miner Nation Report is brought to you by the UPS stores with two locations serving you, one on Park Avenue, the other in Kimball Junction, and Elliott Work Group, creating community one building at a time.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak. Let's get back into the second half of my interview with former Congressman Bob Inglis, talking about the conservative approach to addressing climate change and clean energy options. He's also the founder of the Energy and Enterprise Initiative. He's going to be in town giving talks starting today. And also tomorrow, I'll give you some details after that interview. Let's get back to the interview. You were once skeptical about climate change or human-influenced climate change. And then over time, you saw that the science had a lot of reality to it. But you also said your children played a role in you changing your mind. Talk about that.
Yeah, actually, I was completely dismissive. out of ignorance, I hadn't looked into it at all. All I knew was that Al Gore was for it, and therefore I was against it.
Right.
And that really was the end of the analysis for me. Until I was running again. I've been in Congress 6 years, and I was out 6 years. And I was running again in 2004. And my son, the oldest of our five children, was voting for the first time. He just turned 18. And so he came to me and said, "Dad, I'll vote for you, but you're going to clean up your act on the environment." So I had this new constituency. You know, his four sisters agreed, his mother agreed. They could all change the locks on the doors. So a very important constituency that I need to respond to. And I started looking into it, went back to Congress, I got on the Science Committee, had the opportunity to go to Antarctica, saw the evidence in the ice core drillings, had the opportunity to go a second time to Antarctica, and got inspired really by the faith in action of an Aussie climate scientist, and came back and introduced a revenue-neutral carbon tax. Now, note to self, probably best not to introduce revenue-neutral carbon tax in 2009, the teeth of the Great Recession.
Nice.
So timing wasn't very good for me. I probably should have been a little bit more careful about the timing, but the Great Recovery is going to take hold at some point, and when it does, I think we've got an opportunity to advance this very conservative concept.
I want to talk a little bit about the role of faith-based organizations and the role of organized religion in promoting environmental stewardship. What can organized religion do to better help educate their followers on these issues?
I think it's very important. It's a hugely important constituency. People of faith in conservative circles have a wonderful opportunity to lead here and to discharge their stewardship obligation. And I realize that some conservatives feel that there's some kind of contest between faith and science.
Right.
I don't see that contest. In fact, science affirms my faith. I'm very excited about scientists discovering the intricacies of the creation, because in those intricacies, we see the beauty and orderliness of the Creator. And it's really an occasion of worship. In fact, that's what inspired me. I just mentioned that Aussie climate scientist and his faith and action inspiring me. We were on the Great Barrier Reef, and he was showing me things. And long before we had an opportunity to talk about what his faith might be, I could see it in his eyes. I could hear it in his voice. He was worshiping God in the creation. Not worshiping the creation. He's worshiping God behind the creation. And so, you know, that's my view of us and God and science, is that some people think that we shouldn't invade the province of God, that to go discover these things somehow intrudes on God's territory.
Right.
I don't think so. I think that us and God and science is sort of like Marion and our wife and our five children. We wanted them all to walk. We wanted them to take those first steps, took pictures of it, encouraged them. I think that's us and God and science. He wants us to discover the intricacies of his creation. And just like us encouraging our kids to walk and then run, he's saying, come on, I'll show you how. It's incredible, beyond your imagination, how I did this. But some people, I understand, have this view that, no, don't go there. But I think it's an exciting endeavor of faith, really, and the people who developed the modern scientific method were people of faith, because they saw this creation and its orderliness, and they thought it reflected the beauties of the Creator.
But yet at the same time, you know, your state, South Carolina, is a very religious state. As you say, it's the shiny buckle on the Bible Belt. But yet, I guess they had a different opinion with respect to the environment and faith.
Yeah, so you were politely saying, yes, I got tossed out in the Republican primary in 2010.
Right.
So I think that many people in what really probably is the shiniest buckle on the Bible Belt here in South Carolina, and perhaps the reddest district in the reddest state of the nation, see it differently. And like I say, I want to respect that view, but I also want to ask them, isn't it okay to discover the intricacies of the creation? Shouldn't we not grudgingly accept the science? Shouldn't we, in fact, celebrate the science and say, it's amazing what these people are discovering? They're using these God-given gifts to discover the orderliness of his creation,
right,
and discover the disorder that we may be bringing to it, and there's a way to correct it. So all that means is, that's great. It's sort of like, would we go back to the days when we didn't know how to treat cancer as well as we know now? We don't know yet how well to treat it. In the future, it'll be even better.
Right.
So let's embrace that. Let's not disputed or dragged there kicking and screaming. Let's lead the parade.
Your visit out here next week is going to be sponsored in part by Utah Interfaith Power and Light, you know, a great organization. They do great work out here. And let's talk a little bit about your visit here. Why are you coming to Utah?
Utah is this wonderfully conservative state that we want to test these ideas in. We want to trot them out. We want to show them to fellow conservatives in Utah. And we figure that together with the felt need in Utah for better air at times of the year when things get bad there,
right,
that with that felt need and with a strong sense of conservative values and conservative role of the government, that if we equipped some conservatives with that solution that fits with their philosophy, then perhaps it can spread from there.
How do you measure success, you know, with respect to this initiative, with respect to your visit, the talks you're going to give? How do you quantify success? Is it literally people coming up to you and say, you know, Bob, once I was skeptical too, but after listening to you and going and visiting your website, I've changed my mind? Or is it something fuzzier than that?
Well, in the long term, success will be us lighting up the world with affordable, abundant energy. And that will be through innovation that hopefully we develop here in America and take to the rest of the world. And as a conservative free enterprise guy, I hope we make some money on it, because you know, it's great when you can do well by doing good. The shorter range goal is to price carbon. And that means legislation that would fix these problems in the marketplace. Because we see this as mostly an economics problem, not an environmental problem. If we fix economics, the environmental thing will take care of itself. Then the very short-term objective in coming to Utah will be to persuade conservatives to step forward and engage and to stop shrinking in science denial.
I wish you all the best and the best of luck in your visit and your talks. Bob Inglis, a former congressman from South Carolina, will share his conservative plan that utilizes the free enterprise system to address our need for both energy and clean air. He's going to be speaking at several locations starting Tuesday, September 17th, and also Wednesday, September 18th. Is there a website people can go to get information about that?
We'd happily have them visit energyandenterprise.com, but okay. Craig, I think, has the email or the website address for the Interfaith Power and Light.
Yes, he just handed it to me. It's utahipl.org, www.utahipl.org for more details on your visits and your talks. Thanks again very much, Bob, for taking the time to come and talk to us this morning on This Green Earth.
Well, great to be with you, Chris. Thanks so much.
And that was my interview last week with Bob Inglis, who was going, like I say, he's going to be in town. He's speaking today at 11 at the Hinckley Institute at the University of Utah. And then later this afternoon, he'll be up at Weber State giving another hour's talk there. And then Wednesday, tomorrow, he will be at the Bill and Viv Gore building in Westminster College at 7:30. Giving a talk. And I say he's also giving a talk to the entire Utah State Legislature. I believe that's also Wednesday. That's not open to the public. But really fascinating guy, fascinating subject. And go to their website, the Energy and Enterprise Initiative, to learn more about his concepts and ideas. Really interesting. We only got a couple more minutes. I need to take a break. We'll come back and thank Brian once again. It's This Green Earth. We'll be back.
Since 1983, we've been trying to say something clever in support of our favorite radio station. This is Ann from Park City Nursery and the Park City Tree Ranch, complimenting KPCW for making interesting radio under strict regulations. We try to do the same given our short growing season, various microclimates and soils. We know what grows at parkcitynursery.com.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
This is Green Earth, and it's time to wrap up real quick. Let me thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Republic Services, Habitat for Humanity's Restore, Rocky Mountain Power, San Francisco Design, and Prudential Utah Real Estate. You can learn more about us and other activities on our Facebook page, KPCW, This Green Earth. Again, thanks to Brian McInerney for coming on and telling us all about the weather and the climate and what's going on here. Good job, Brian.
Thank you.
We'll
see
you in 3 months around December 21st.
Okay. That'll be good.
And again, like us on Facebook. Join us next week. We'll be talking about Haiti and the environmental issues going on there. It's one last thing. You're listening to KPCW 91.9 FM Park City, only in Park City, only on KPCW. This is KPCW Park City.